Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Professor Denny Rancourt. Denny was unfairly treated by the University of Ottawa. He's been on this program several times before. He's involved in a major struggle for justice, and I wanted to get Denny back on to update the status of the situation. It really is outrageous. I write volumes about police state injustice in America. It goes on in Canada the same way. You know, Canada, population-wise, is a lot smaller than America. Territory-wise, it's about the same size, maybe a little bigger. Lots more open spaces. Population in America is huge. Both countries treat people they should respect and honor with supreme injustice. Some of the best in both societies get targeted unjustly. Denny is certainly one of those people. We'll get into the program and let Denny give us an update on what's been happening with him since the last time he came on. Let me just make a couple of comments preceding that. Every day I focus on so much, I try to write on things that particularly concern me based on particular events, either that day or the day before. And whatever seems most striking to me is what I want to comment on it. I've written volumes on Syria. I've been busy on two other articles this morning that I'll get out tomorrow. I haven't had time to check a report I know is absolutely false. I saw an outrageous BBC report claiming the Assad government slaughtered 200 men, women, and children. They isolated them, put them someplace, either in a building, in an isolated area, and they murdered them. This is classic insurgent violence. It's happened repeatedly throughout the conflict since it began around February, March 2011. Again, many dozens, scores, hundreds of innocent people have been targeted and murdered the same way. The Foreign Invader Death Squad, sponsored by America mainly, also other key NATO partners, the regional rogue allies like Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Jordan, and of course Israel is very, very much involved in this. Anything that goes on in the region, Israel has its dirty hands all over, and they know exactly what's going on, and they're part of it, and they're part of the propaganda machine vilifying Assad. Assad is an authoritarian government. But compared to Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, I could go on and on. The Syrian government seems almost saintly. Well, I wouldn't call it saintly, but by comparison, it seems that way. Not a word is said about these other rogue regimes, only the Syrian government. And what's the difference between them? The other ones kowtow to Washington. Syria is independent. Iran is targeted. Iran is independent. It doesn't kowtow to Washington. That's a crime, according to the people who run America. Same thing for Israel. The beat goes on and on. So violence rages in Syria. I'll write more about it. Didn't do it today for tomorrow. A brief word about the fiscal cliff, and then we'll get Denny to comment on what's been happening with him. I put out a new article today. I called it Cliff Notes. I also wrote a major one for tomorrow. I wrote about how to resolve the situation responsibly. It's a major article. It's got an awful lot in it. In articles, I've written about a lot of this stuff before. You know, whether we're talking about ending corporate personhood or putting money power back where it belongs in public hands, about a progressive tax system, a tax on speculation, many other things that are really progressive ideas. A big one, drastically cutting down on the military, ending imperial wars, closing all overseas bases. I cover a lot of this, many, many responsible topics in the article I write. The fiscal cliff is a hoax. It's an absolute hoax. I've explained it in all my articles. The deal is destroying America's social contract. There's no urgency to address the deficit and national debt by midnight Monday night, I guess. Midnight Monday night, New Year's Eve. There's no urgency to do that. Claiming it is absolutely duplicitous bunk. But you hear it in headlines all the time. You know, we'll all turn into a pumpkin if we don't come up with a deal. Well, nobody's going to turn into a pumpkin. And the so-called fiscal cliff, well, there is no fiscal cliff. There is a debt problem. There is an annual deficit problem. It's so simple to fix it responsibly. good economics and good governments and good government, they're not rocket science. They're elementary when you bring it down to basics. I cover it in my article. It'll be top featured on my blog tomorrow, Steve Lindman blog. It'll circulate, I'm sure, widely. Take a look at it and see the easy, responsible, effective way to end this debate once and for all. And why won't it happen? Because there's no political will to do it. There's a great political will to kill America's social contract, and that's what the debate is all about. Only a few details remain to be worked out. The basic scheme was agreed on by both parties long ago, before Obama ever became president, before George Bush became president, but it intensified under succeeding administrations. Clinton, Bush, Bush II, Obama. This game has a long, long, dirty way to run. Teddy, I just wanted to get a couple of things off my chest. Welcome to the program. Let me get into your situation. You alerted me that there's been a lot going on since I last had you on the program. Bring me and listeners up to date. Refresh their memory on exactly what your situation is and how it came about and so on, and then bring us up to date.
Okay, I'll do that with pleasure, Stephen. It's always a pleasure to be on your show. And thank you for your earlier introduction of me as well. Well, listen, many of your listeners have heard me before, but I'll just recap very briefly. I was a very dedicated and highly ethical professional educator, a university professor of physics, and I was also a researcher. I was at the highest rank of full professor when I was, and I was tenured, of course. I had a full professorship, and I was fired for, well, they made up a pretext. I mean, I think the real reason was how outspoken I was, being very critical of the institution and of its administration. But the pretext was that they didn't like my grading of students in one course. They actually said that my grading had been fraudulent with regards to 23 students in an advanced physics course. And that was the pretext they used. Now, they advanced that pretext, and it quickly became apparent. They fired me in 2009. Since then, we've been before a tribunal. And at the tribunal, their main witness, the dean that fired me, under the orders of the president, admitted that they had no evidence that there had been fraudulent grading, none whatsoever. He admitted that in sworn testimony. So, I mean, they really have no case, and they were just using their power indiscriminately, in my opinion, to get me off campus, to get rid of me. And so then you have to go through a long legal battle to show that it was a wrongful dismissal and to get back your job and so on. And so I'm still in the process of that now, years later. At the same time, they have more recently in the last year or more, funded a private lawsuit against me where a university professor, a law professor at the university, is supposedly privately suing me for defamation, but in fact the lawsuit is funded by the university again. And this is a large litigation. It's what I would consider a slap suit, a strategic lawsuit to prevent my public participation. It's really meant to crush me, I believe. And it's a $1 million lawsuit. They want to put me out of house and home. And it's an aggressive lawsuit using the biggest law firms in Canada. And so that's what I'm in the middle of now. And within that lawsuit, I'm using my power to the best of my ability, which means, you know, I have power because I am a member of the middle class, I'm highly educated, I have some social status, and therefore I can stand up, even though I don't have the money to pay for a law firm to defend me. I can be self-represented. I'm able to learn the law fairly quickly. I'm able to learn the procedures and to stand up in court. I'm used to public speaking. And so I defend myself. And this exposes them to a large extent. And when I say them, I mean the parties that are suing me, but also the court itself, because the court itself, I have found as a self-represented litigant, is, in my opinion, highly biased against self-represented persons. Now, this isn't a structural bias, because structurally they say that they're not biased and that they're open and they try to make the system accessible to everyone. But in fact, when you look at the judges and their in-court behavior, they're much more able to hear and to understand these high-ranking lawyers than when you talk. When you talk, it's almost as though they were wearing a filter on their ears, and all they can hear is blah, 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 self-represented litigant, blah, 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 self-represented litigant. It's almost like that's all they hear, because they don't respond in the same way. They don't give signs that they're understanding the arguments. They sort of move on and then listen to the other side some more. And so I really get a sense, and this is my opinion, my perception, but I really get a sense that it's a terribly biased system, biased through attitude and biased through perception and professional preference to have persons be represented. So that's the system that I'm stuck in. It's a massive lawsuit. There have been, within a lawsuit, there are mini lawsuits that are called motions. We've been through more than 20 of these motions, where each time you have to defend yourself in front of a judge, submit complicated documents, follow all kinds of procedures, and be attacked in every which way, cross-examined, and so on. So I have learned a great deal by going through that lengthy and complex process time and time again. So I'm getting much better at it, and I'm told routinely by the judges that they've rarely seen such high-quality legal documents from a self-represented person, and in fact, never. And also by my opponents will often say things like, he's one of the most experienced litigants in the city of Ottawa, meaning, you know, he's an opponent that you have to consider equal to us, and therefore punish him severely when he breaks these rules, or when he doesn't, when he pretends not to know these rules, is what they would say, right?
Cindy, can I throw in a comment? Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
But my understanding is that you are, dare I say, world-renowned in two fields, physics, I guess your main field, and environmental science. And before this litigation is over, I think we're going to make it a trifecta.
Well, that's possible, but it's true. I am internationally recognized at the highest levels in science, and that's established through my many, many plenary and invited keynote talks at international conferences, and my many, many peer-reviewed publications, over 100, and chapters and books and so on. So there's no question that, scientifically, I was one of the most highly funded researchers on the campus at the University of Ottawa in the period when they fired me. So there's no question about my scientific credentials. And in fact, there have been letters of support from all over the world from scientists who said very renowned and celebrated and award-winning scientists have said things like that I'm one of Canada's top scientists. So that's established, and now I'm trying to put that scientific training to use in my defense.
Denny, let me add one more thing as well.
Yeah.
From information that I had in one of my articles, that you also stood out outstandingly pedagogically based on feedback from your students.
Well,
that your teaching
true.
Methods were so innovative that students were able to learn better, and they thanked you for it. And you came up with a system that emphasized learning. That's what teaching is all about, learning. And your students learned, and they were very grateful for it, and they respected you for what you did. So to fire you on pedagogical grounds, they absolutely don't wash.
No, it's an absurd contradiction, the pretext they used to fire me, because the students just loved me, and there was one student association letter in particular one year where they represented the entire program that I was teaching in, and they said that I was one of the most inspiring and gifted teachers they'd ever had, and they wanted to make that point to the administration, because there was some of the administration's rumbling sort of got out, and so they made sure that they made that point. But that's true. I mean, I could see it in my classes. The students loved my courses, and they would bring in their friends and sometimes their parents, and to sit in and see what it was like and to participate. You know, it was very exhilarating to teach at the university level and have that kind of response and to fill the rooms like that. There's one time it was very touching for me. A parent was shadowing her daughter and going around to all of her daughter's classes, and her daughter happened to take, even though she wasn't in the sciences, she took my science and society course. And there was a lot of criticism of that course because I had invited Palestinian speakers to talk about the injustices in Palestine and so on. And so that was severely criticized by the mainstream media and by some Zionist protagonists on campus, I would say. And so this woman, when she saw that I was being attacked for my teaching, she came to my defense and wrote a letter to the editor of the national newspaper, the Globe and Mail in Canada, which is like the equivalent of the New York Times, but only in Canada. And she, her letter was published, and it basically said, I'm paraphrasing, but it basically said, listen, I was shadowing my daughter, and I went to all her classes for, you know, I was doing this for a period of a couple of weeks, and this man's class was the only one that was anything like what I wanted my daughter to experience at university. And it was just, you know, there was participation, it was exhilarating, it was real, whereas everything else was just so terribly deafening and boring and so on. And so I'm paraphrasing liberally, you know, but she wrote this quite powerful letter that was published in the national paper in that way. So these are the kinds of experiences that I've had on the teaching side, you know. It's been recognized by the students, and I could see it in their eyes. I knew that the students were learning, for example, first-year physics, introductory physics, much more deeply and with more excitement than they ever would have if I had used the traditional teaching methods that I had used earlier in my career and that my colleagues were using. So I have no doubt that that's the case. But here we are, move forward, many years, and I'm embroiled in this gigantic battle. And they have cleared me of my financial resources, because every time you win, you lose one of these mini trials, these motions, they force you to pay the legal costs of the other side, even though the other side is being fully funded without a cap. So the president has sworn under testimony that they're funding this without a cap. Even if that's the case, I still have to pay their legal fees when I lose a motion. So as a result of that, I've lost tens of thousands of dollars repeatedly, and I'm broke now. And so I need money just to file documents with the court. I mean, just making photocopies of the last motion cost me, and having the legal books bound cost me about $600. The court transcripts cost hundreds of dollars and so on. So I'm actually at a stage now where I've asked your listeners in the past, and I said, listen, if you have some extra money and you want to donate to my legal fund, I promise you I'll use every penny to fight this system and to expose its injustices to the best of my ability, you know?
Explain how listeners can do that. And let's repeat it at the end of the program. I just can't imagine a legal cause, Denny, more important and more just than yours, where literally you are a person the university should have honored. I talk about people who end up in America's gulag, who they should build a statue to instead of putting them behind bars. My friend Lynn Stewart is one of them, a very distinguished longtime human rights lawyer, serving 10 years in prison for representing the wrong client. And in your case, a very distinguished professor, your students loved you, an expert in your fields, and this is the way they treated you, because the president of the University of Ottawa, Alan Rock, an ex-political hack, dare I call him that, and I want to call him a lot worse, let's call him a fascist political hack. He targeted you for doing the wrong thing. You deserve support, Denny. Tell listeners how they can do that.
Well,
any amount they give you is just that much less that you have to worry about raising to defend yourself, as you have every right to do.
Yeah, I really appreciate anything that anyone can send my way, and so the easiest way is to go to one of my blogs. This blog is easy to find. It's called Activist Teacher. So as one word, activistteacher.blogspot.ca, okay? And when you get to the front page of that blog called Activist Teacher, in the right column at the very top, you immediately see a bold phrase that says, donate to the Denis Rancourt Legal Fund. And you can just click on those words, and it sends you into a page on the web that explains the various ways that you can donate to my legal fund, including there's a PayPal button there that you can click, and so on that donation page.
Denny, I just Googled Activist Teacher separately.
Yeah.
And I did it space between the two words.
Yeah.
You can either do it space
or
no
space.
Yeah, you
can Google and find the blog.
Oh, yeah.
Or you can use the actual hyperlink address, which is activistteacher.blogspot.ca.
Well, it brought me to the site.
Will probably give you the same thing.
The site is top listed on the Google page. I'm right on it on the right-hand side. Photo, above your photo. Donate to the Denny Rancourt Legal Fund.
That's
Click
right.
That takes you right there, shows you what to do. Anything, anybody can afford. Everybody can afford
something.
People have
been very generous. I'm really thankful. It's very encouraging, but it's still only a fraction of what I'll need just to continue the battle. And I want to tell you about the battle. I want to tell you the next steps in the battle, because it's very exciting what you're able to do if you don't give up and you just keep pushing it and insisting on justice within the system, you see. Because what it forces the system to examine itself and to be exposed to public scrutiny as you move up the ladder to higher and higher courts, you see. And so one of the next things I'm doing is I'm, for the first time, and most lawyers have never done this in their careers, but for the first time in my battle, I'm doing what is called a leave to appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada, the highest court in the land. And what I want them to agree to allow me to appeal is the fact that in the lower court, I complained about a judge's apparent bias. I said, there's this cogent evidence that this judge, that there's an appearance of bias with this judge because he has a contract with the university, which is a party in the case. So here's the judge with a scholarship fund contract with the university and several other things. So there were many connections between this judge and the university, which was one of the parties, and I said, listen, that's at least an appearance of bias. So the jurisprudence is such that when you have an appearance of bias like this, you've got to stop everything, replace the judge, and also all of the decisions of that judge have to be rendered invalid, and you have to do the process again to re-decide those points, you see. So it's a very important concept. It's well established in the common law. And so I asked for I was putting forward a motion to get a judicial determination of whether or not there's an appearance of bias. And what the court did through a series of steps is it denied me a hearing that would have allowed a determination of bias. So I never got a hearing on the merits of the motion I was trying to put forward. Never. The court just killed it. And they did it legally, in the sense that there are certain rules that allow this in the way that it turned out because of the circumstances of the case. The rules allowed them to kill it in this way. And so what I'm doing in going to the Supreme Court of Canada is I'm saying, listen, these rules that allow this are not constitutional, because we have a constitutional right to a fair and impartial process, and therefore rules that allow that you can bar someone from making a complaint about bias are therefore unconstitutional. So that is the thrust of my leave to appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada.
So you've already made that appeal, Denny.
No, I'm just making it these days.
Okay.
So that appeal I'm preparing, these are the legal documents I'm working on these days. And it's the first time I do this, so it's quite complicated. There's a whole series of rules and forms to fill out and all kinds of criteria and so on. And I'm going to be filing that this month. Okay.
And they can take their time and review it, and they can accept it, or they can reject it. They can do whatever they want.
Yeah, now, if the Supreme Court, I think it's a very strong case, and if the Supreme Court rejects this appeal, or the permission to go to appeal, the leave to appeal, if they reject that, that means that in such a clear case, it's okay for a lower court to not allow you a hearing on whether or not there's bias or an appearance of bias, you see. So it'll be a pretty significant message that the Supreme Court will be sending to the Canadian public if they don't review this. I think it's a question of national interest whether or not an individual is entitled by right to an impartial process within the court system. You see, I think that's pretty important. In fact, it's one of the founding principles of the common law. There are two founding principles of the common law, what are called natural justice principles. One is that a judge cannot be a judge in his or her own cause. And that's just another way of saying that you're entitled to a completely impartial process. Okay? And the other principle is you're entitled to be heard. You're allowed to make your case. They can't stop you from even being heard. Those are the two most important foundational principles of all rational legal systems in our human societies. So if the Supreme Court of Canada says, oh, whatever, you know, you don't need to have a completely impartial process, you don't need to be heard on whether or not it was an impartial process, the lower court can just bar you from being heard on that and just move on, then I think that will be a huge contradiction of principles, you see?
Oh, it certainly would be, and I absolutely hope it won't happen. Let me throw one more thing in, too. I believe it's still the case that you, who began this situation, absolutely an untrained lawyer, literally a lay person, self-defending. Well, maybe you got some help at the beginning, but you before you started studying the law, you certainly were entirely lay in the field of law, and you're going up against at least one of the most distinguished, powerful law firms in Canada, maybe the most.
There are two of the largest law firms in Canada are the other side.
Two of them, not just one. Two.
That's
of them.
Right. That's right. There's two of them. One is called Gowlings. And the other is called BLG, and I believe they're like number one and number two in terms of size in Canada.
Now, wouldn't it be wonderful if this would be an example in the end that David defeated Goliath, real life?
The odds are very low, but it's worth a shot because the educational value of this is significant.
Oh, absolutely, Denny. And this program, as I said to you before, is an open platform for you to explain your side, and we'll do the best we can getting it out to a world audience. And there's not a damn thing they can do to stop us. Denny, we'll take a short break.
Okay.
We'll come right back. Welcome back. On with Denny Rancourt, discussing his situation. Very unjust. Denny explains it so well. Let me let you pick up, Denny, where you left off. This is such a vital issue, and I say it not just because of you and my respect for you, but a long-time topic for me has been political injustice in its many forms in America. a little bit in Canada, as I've written about some of the unjust things that go on there, but I focus mainly on America. I also focus on what's happening in the Middle East, occupied Palestine, the outrageous Israeli crimes, the long-term occupation. But I talk an awful lot and have written about specific instances of political prisoners in America. Most often they're Muslims. They're targeted for their faith, their ethnicity, sometimes their prominence. They're targeted for doing the right things. Like the largest Muslim charity in America, George Bush shut them down because they gave charity to the wrong recipients. And in their own words, they gave books, not bombs, and toys, not tanks. Well, George Bush criminalized them for it, and the two leading principals got something on the order of about 60 years in prison. They didn't commit any crimes.
Yeah. When these cases go to court, or when they're appealed and they go back to court, even though the persons are in prison and they can be appealed and then they go back to court, something that we can do as activists is show up in court and see it for ourselves. And that has a lot of benefit. That it's more than just signing a petition or becoming conscious of the things and you know, communicating it to others. Because when you show up in court with your person, you're looking the judge in the eye and you're saying to that person with your body language, what you're doing makes little sense. It does not appear to be fair to me. This is not a justice system I can be proud of. Your presence and your attention to what is going on has a powerful effect on the people behind the bench and the people who are making the arguments. So I've seen this with my own eyes. I've seen things turn around and attitudes start to change and players being pressured into behaving in a higher road way because there was attendance at court, you see. And I think this has pressure of this way, community pressure, and making people feel that we activists are part of their community, and we're going to be there, and we're going to be watching them, and we're going to be critiquing them and writing about it, and so on. This is a strong way to connect with these institutions that otherwise just go off on their own and do whatever they like, you know, in a kind of isolation. So you need the public's eye. Principle of an open court, you know, that is accepted now in the common law, and so you're allowed to go into the courtroom, you're allowed to see it for yourself, you're allowed to write about it without the threat of being sued for defamation or whatever. These are very powerful rights that we have as citizens, and it's a place where you can really play an important role. And what I found is that the people who came in to see the court process that I was involved with, a lot of them, it changed their lives. I mean, there's typically a room full of supporters when I walk into the courtroom, and they see it for themselves. They see when the judge has a fit, and they see when something not too kosher is happening in terms of the communication between the top lawyers on the other side and the judge, you know. And the judges can see that people are seeing this, and they feel uncomfortable about it. At least that's the body language as I understand it, you know. But more importantly, the individuals that were sitting in the room there and they saw these things happening before their own eyes, they were momentarily traumatized. And they were deeply, deeply educated about the true nature of how this process works and what the system is like. And, you know, the one time I asked a judge to recuse himself, and he did, but he was very angry about the whole thing. And he threatened me with contempt of court, which is a criminal offense, if I continued to want to advance my arguments so that he would consider recusing himself. And the people that I know who witnessed that, my, they were shocked by it, you know. And it made them into more committed activists as well. They decided this is so obscene that I've got to do something about it. And I've seen people become much more committed in this battle to make the institutions our institutions. And so it going into court can have a lot of beneficial effects, if you say, on the individual that participates in that way. So I encourage it. But I should tell you about my another legal motion that I've been involved with and give you an update on that one as well. You'll recall, your listeners will recall, that I'm involved. I put forward a motion to try and get the lawsuit dismissed on the basis that the university was paying the plaintiff for all of her legal fees. So, and that the plaintiff was then going to give a scholarship fund from the money that she won, was going to give it to the university as a scholarship fund. Now, that's called champerty. That's a legal term, and it means that you can't do that. You can't fund a litigation and then benefit from the proceeds of that litigation. And so I basically sued the plaintiff and the university for champerty in a motion. And that motion was just heard recently, very recently, just this month. And it was horrible the way that I was not allowed to speak. I wasn't given enough time to make my arguments and to make my case. And I complained about that, and it just didn't matter. They did it all in a day, and I think it would have needed 2.5 days to properly do this trial, this mini trial. So I felt very unjustly treated by that. And so I will be appealing that. And because it's a motion that could have put an end to the action, I'm allowed to appeal this one as of right, so I don't have to ask for permission to appeal it. So there's a good chance when I see the ruling, I will be appealing that to the highest court in the province, in Ontario here. It's called the Court of Appeal of Ontario. So that is the next step with regards to getting it recognized that it was improper for the University of Ottawa to fund the legal fees of the plaintiff that is suing me in a private lawsuit. You see, so that's the update on the champerty motion, and so these battles are going full forward, as they say.
Denny, it's like a war where you're literally fighting battles on multiple fronts at the same time.
And
the opposition outguns you, but your courage.
And they get to choose the battle rules.
Oh, they sure
do. Change the rules as we go, and they get to like, for example, these next motions that I'll be fighting, there are other motions that I've got scheduled. The registrar of the court scheduled these motions. And then the other side argued that they wanted the dates changed. And so the judge is going to change the dates to things closer to what they want. Even though I went through the formal process of getting filing and hearing dates from the registrar, followed all the rules, now they're going to try to pick dates that advantage them and disadvantage me, you see. That's how I understand what they're doing, because there's no reason, really, to change these dates other than these tactical advantages, in my opinion. So when you're subjected to that, it's despicable, It's really nasty. And it's really a shame that the judges will often just go along with it and accept the pretext as to why it's being done without questioning them. They like to assume that powerful lawyers have proper motives and that everyone else has improper motives. It seems to be, from my perception and in my opinion, a way that they see things through those glasses, you see, which is, where are you in terms of the legal profession, your status, and that determines how your actions are going to be perceived.
They all know each other, too. It's like an old boys network. They belong to the same clubs. Their wives know each other. They go out to dinner together. They socialize together. And you come in, and they don't know who you are.
That's right. So why would they give me the benefit of the doubt? Why would they upset their system because someone is asking for something that is unusual or that seems to imply that maybe someone on their side did something that wasn't quite proper, and so on, right? Yeah, it's the dice are loaded. There's no doubt. I mean, as a self-represented litigant, that's what I see. And now, can you imagine if I didn't have the training and the education that I have? Can you imagine how difficult it would be to get any semblance of justice.
I think it would be impossible,
self-represented litigants, especially in family court, where children are involved and family welfare is involved, and they just get, you know, they just get rolled over by the system. It's just horrendous to see. It's a terrible way that society deals with families, this family law system. But that's a whole other topic. But, you know, in all of this, I managed to do something else, Stephen. My book is coming out.
Oh, marvelous. And the title is?
Well, this is my... I've written several chapters in books, you know, from a scientific perspective, but this is my first book as a sole author, and it's called Hierarchy and Free Expression in the Fight Against Racism. And it's a radical book. And it's just come out with Stairway Press, and it's already available electronically with Amazon, but it's going to be released, the paper-bound copy. The release date is the 15th of January, so very soon. And there's a website for the book that gives the endorsements that people have given for the book. There's a sample of part of a chapter in there. There's a really nice website if your readers want to go to it. The website's easy to find. It's called Fight Against Racism Book. Fight Against Racism Book, all one word, .wordpress.com. That's the hyperlink. Fight Against Racism Book. .wordpress.com.
Denny, talk a little bit about what's in the book.
Oh, it's let me read one of the endorsements. It's hard to explain because I really go to the root of things, but let me read one of the endorsements. This is an endorsement by Cynthia McKinney, whom you know.
Sure do.
She is the first African American woman elected to represent Georgia in the U.S. Congressional House of Representatives, and she's a former presidential candidate for the Green Party, and she's just a powerhouse of an ethical politician.
She really is, and she's been on this program a few times.
Uh-huh. Well, she's wonderful. Now, she read the book, and this is what she had to say. This is on the back cover of the book. She says, Denis Dancourt has turned the entire notion of racism on its head, and at the same time exposes racist acts committed by others to deflect that characterization from sticking at the highest levels of the academy. Then she goes on to say, North American civil rights defenders need this book at this time. And then she says, Dancourt's deeply incisive fight against racism brings us back to the reality of the struggle, away from the maneuvering for class advantage, and away from the victim's desire to create illusions of state-given justice. So you can tell from her endorsement that my experiences in the court system have colored how I write this book, obviously. But it's just coming out.
Oh, I'm delighted, Denny. I hope it attracts a lot of attention. I hope it raises your eminence is way up there. I hope it still raises it another notch or two. You certainly are a man for all seasons, and an honor to have you on this program, Denny.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be here, Stephen. Do you want me to try and tell you a little bit of what's in this book?
Yeah, do it. We have about 10 minutes left. We'll get you back. We'll talk more about the book. We'll have another update on what's going on legal-wise. But explain a little bit more about what's in the book.
What I've done is I've reviewed the scientific and social science literature on the effects of hierarchy on the individual. Hierarchy meaning, you know, a power structure that controls your life, okay, and how that structure is layered and how it gets into every aspect of your life and controls your life. And so I've reviewed the literature that I consider the most important literature on how that actually affects you as an individual, affects your health, affects how you think, affects how you see yourself even. And I've used that to explain that racism is a part of that. In other words, that racism and its use by the various actors in society, by its use I mean, you know, accusing others of racism or being racist, all the different uses that racism can have within society are modulated and are determined largely by this hierarchical structure. So in this way, when some progressive elements claim that they're fighting racism, because their claim and their push is inscribed in this hierarchy, they may actually be strengthening the racist system. So I try to develop tests and ways that people can recognize whether or not they're helping or hurting, and causing people to re-examine themselves within the hierarchical structure in order to recognize that sometimes they're claiming to fight racism, but they're actually reinforcing it. And that's why Cynthia says, you know, that I've turned the notion on its head. Those are the points I'm trying to get across in the book, because there's a lot of anti-racist policy of the state that actually is much more harmful than helpful and ingrains us within a racist system instead of helping like it purports to, you see? That's what the book is about. And it explains how to fight back. It explains how to effectively fight this racism. So it's hard to explain because I go through it, you know, step by step, and I give a lot of examples of how hierarchy determines things such as even our personal health. You know, I start there. How hierarchy determines our education, how we're going to be educated, how the educational system will mold us, how we'll come to perceive things. And what's most shocking is how we perceive even ourselves, how we have an improper and unhealthy perception of ourselves because we're locked into this hierarchical control. So I'm putting it in kind of theoretical language now, but in the book, I'm told, it's explained very plainly and very clearly. So I'm hoping that many people will... Well, in fact, there was a student, a black student who read... She heard that I was writing this book, and she asked me for an advance copy. And so I sent her one, a confidential copy of the book, and she said she read it several times, and it is the book that has most transformed her life, that has had the most impact on her. She changed her graduate research as a result of it, and she changed her activism, her anti-racism activism, dramatically, just from having read this book. So she was, and she has communicated with me several times to tell me these things. So I know now from that one example that the book can have a very strong impact on someone, and can give them new insights into this difficult topic of racism, you see.
Denny, in America for sure, I imagine in Canada as well, racism is not a common topic that comes up through the major media, and there's no question that America is an extremely racist country, and I've talked about and I've written a little bit about that the civil rights gains of the 1960s, they're all gone, and it's been a while, but I remember quoting a civil rights leader, I think from the NAACP, who basically said, things aren't just lost from the 1960s games.
Yeah.
They're worse today than ever.
And that quote came from about three years ago.
That.
You know, Malcolm X predicted that would be the case, that this couldn't possibly be helped and it would only make things worse. Malcolm X was very critical of many aspects of the civil rights movement. And a lot of Malcolm X's ideas and analysis I use in this book, actually. Because Malcolm X had some very deep insights on how to produce justice from the starting point of a very racist society, how do you actually achieve it, you know? And so he was, especially at first, he was very critical of even civil rights leaders. And then at the end, he cooperated more with them as the two grew closer together, you know. Martin Luther King and Malcolm X grew closer together in their approach and in their philosophies as time went on and as they criticized each other and heard of each other's views. So I do touch on that in the book. And also the book, you'll be interested to know, has a really nice, broad academic introduction written by someone else who's been on your show a number of times, Mahdi.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Yeah, Mahdi wrote the introduction to the book. Now, Mahdi's is called Mahdi.
He's a Middle East expert. I didn't know he was an expert in racism.
I believe how you pronounce it. And so he wrote, because Mahdi is a brilliant social scientist, and he wrote sort of the academic context of this book, and reviewed the social scientists that have said things along the lines of what I'm saying, and has compared our thoughts. You see, so it gives you it puts my book into the broader academic context of where these ideas fit. But it turns out there's only a few intellectuals who have ever gone that route of insisting on the preeminence of hierarchy to understand these phenomena, you see. Yeah.
Oh, that really sounds marvelous. Well, I think you have probably written a very important book, Denny, and I certainly hope it gets a lot of play, and we can highlight it when you come on this program, talk about it, tell listeners how they can check it out. It's an important topic, Denny, because it certainly does not get a lot of play in major discourse, and it's a topic that needs to get a lot of play. One of the first things that strikes me is a topic I wrote about, one of the first articles I ever wrote, a major article on the U.S. prison system, and I called it what it is. It's a gulag. It's by far the largest prison system in the world, about half the people in it, 2.234 million. No other country approaches America's prison system. It really expanded dramatically since the late 1970s, early 1980s, and half the people in it are disadvantaged black people. Another great segment are poor Latinos. That's where they are. They're mostly nonviolent. A lot of them are drug-related. They should never be in prison in the first place. Yeah. But it's become a profitable enterprise.
Oh.
There's a privatized segment of the prison system, so there's a lot of money to be made.
Yeah.
It's a very ugly system, and at its core, virulent racism.
Yeah. I touch on that in the book as well. Listeners can pre-order the book directly from the publisher. That's probably the best way. When you go to this website, you can do that.
Oh, go to Amazon and get it.
You can get it electronically from Amazon. It's cheaper that way. And unfortunately, it's not a particularly cheap book. The cover price for the print copy is $20, and the price for the electronic copy is $10.
Oh, that's very inexpensive.
It could have been cheaper, but that's the way it worked out with the publisher. But you can order it directly from the publisher. Just Fight Against Racism book.wordpress.com. They'll take you to how you can order it.
Again, Fight Against Race. Or just fightagainstracism.com. Go there.
Fight Against Racism book.
Fight Against Racism book.
.com.
Fight Against Racism book. .com.
.wordpress.com, yeah.
That's easy to remember. And Denny, I mean, anything written by you is something I would consider must reading, and I'm delighted that you tackle this topic. It's a sorely neglected one, and who better to do it than somebody committed to justice like you, Denny?
Would you do me the honor of reviewing the book?
I could do it briefly. I used to do a lot of book reviews, but I'm so involved in my other writing, I had to stop, Denny, because I'm only one person and I can only do so much.
Oh, yeah. Yes, it's very time-consuming.
It's very time-consuming. My preference is to get authors on the program and discuss the book for the entire program sometimes. We'll do it again on this program, Denny, and we'll get you back.
You know what I'll do? I'll do these book launches. People are inviting me to do these book launches once I get the paper copy. And I'll be able to tell you about how the launches went.
Oh, terrific.
What the reaction is and so on.
Denny, I look forward to getting you back again. I need to wind up the program to get ready for the next host. It was a marvelous hour. We'll continue. This is a to-be-continued series. We'll talk more about the book. We'll talk more about your litigation. We'll highlight the need for justice. And we'll really hit hard on this. It's big for me. You're living it. It's certainly big for you. But it's always been a major topic for me for most of the time that I've been writing. I look forward to getting you back again, Denny. Thank you so much. Join us again Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.